On this week's Bet the Process podcast, Rufus and I have one of our dear friends on, Cade Massey, to talk about the NFL draft. And we end up talking a lot about decision science, about how to have influence in organizations. And Rufus and I talk a little bit about some of the most important sports betting topics, like Jonte Porter, and why you shouldn't just follow Rufus's or tail Rufus's golf blindly. So with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast. Bet the process. It's not that typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge in Massey Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic.
Welcome to another episode of the Bet the Process podcast, where it's draft week, which is exciting. I wanted to talk to you about a couple things. One was the Jonte Porter situation. I know this has been talked ad nauseum, but one of the things that I think is interesting about all of this, we've already talked about the idea that, like, one of the reasons that this was, there were people are able to make money off of this, or these, you know, whoever, was because of these predatory same game parlay products, blah, blah, blah. We've talked about that in the lens of, you know, you can maybe wax philosophical on that.
I mean, I'll definitely say that they're predatory in a way, but at the same time, people do enjoy them. They're entertaining for people. I mean, there's a reason that they are so popular. So, but I do think it creates, I think we both know that being able, it creates this surface area to defend, and it creates the opportunity to leverage in a way that you couldn't before one role player's performance.
One area that I think is interesting about this is, I don't think anyone's talked about the role that the NBA and the structure of the NBA plays in this. Meaning, think about the setting for him. The team has already decided to tank. They basically are telling him they don't care about winning these games, right? As an organization. And so in his mind, and I'm not defending him, because obviously, like, he had to have known what he was doing was wrong, and certainly the punishment is fine. But I think that the idea that tanking is so prevalent in the NBA, so accepted and so talked about, makes it such that as a player, do you think that he would have done this if his team wasn't tanking? Right? Like, did the tanking make him, like, almost numb to the idea that his performance and this stuff mattered, and it made it easier for him to cognitive dissonance the idea of not necessarily, you know, like, what's the big deal? We're not actually playing to win anyways. What's the big deal if I just make a little money on the side? Like, who's to be hurt by this?
It's something I never thought of, actually, Jeff. And it does make sense. And I do think the incentivizing tanking, which most U.S. major sports leagues kind of do to varying different extents, I don't think is great. It's so different than in Europe, where there's promotion, relegation, and teams are incentivized always to play their best. But I mean, I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that.
Right? I think the answer is unknowable, but I think that the NBA and I mean, I'd love to have Evan on at some point, but we probably can't have him on to talk about this. But the NBA has got to look themselves in the mirror when it comes to things like this, because ultimately, again, like, you know, this is a kid that normally would not be playing, and he's been put in this situation, but he's put in this situation in almost this comical situation where the team is already, like, it's almost very forward that they traded away all their best players. Like, they he's a guy that never would play, and now he's playing. And I don't know. I think there's a role here.
I would say, I mean, this isn't point shaving or anything like that. This is a guy getting ill, quote ill and, or injured and taking himself out of the game. And so it's interesting to me that this can happen because you can do something that has less of an impact on whether the team wins or loses the game and make a lot of money or have a lot of money on the
line.
Maybe
he knows he's bad, and he was like, he thinks he's actually helping the team by going out.
Maybe he parlayed all that with the Raptors winning, his not playing with the Raptors winning. Right.
Yeah. But so he knew there was, like, an opportunity for
I think the thing is when there's such a disconnect between what you're betting on and the actual impact it has on team winning or losing the game, I think that's when there's these opportunities.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the tweet you had about people getting Rufus's golf, which I thought was kind of interesting, and it highlighted some interesting things, right? Like, I'm sure you have a litany of people and sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, the tweet was inspired by a tweet I'd written earlier and some responses to it where someone asked if they could have my golf. And I said, well, if I bet something at minus 120 and if I tweet it out when it's minus 135, like I'm just an asshole. And that's not going to have an edge. And the guy's like, well, it would still be useful for me to have that. Like I would, he basically said, I just want to be on the same side as you. And so that it kind of went from that. So this was not, I mean, obviously this is not a treatise for sophisticated bettors, but I do think there are people out there that aren't as, you know, don't understand this.
No, I thought it was a good, I mean, you got crap on some of your responses from the people that will give you crap no matter what you do. But I thought it was an interesting, you know, because you and I obviously known each other for a long time and I always want to try to see like, oh, can I tell you in golf, I'm like, I know that there's no opportunity, literally, like any time that there's no edge left. And so, you know, maybe just a quick 2 minutes on like this and like the lesson that people should understand it, where really price matters a lot, right? This is the whole idea that price matters a lot. And, you know, just being on the quote unquote right side, that doesn't mean anything because the right side is only based on a price. And if the price has changed, there is no right side.
I mean, I think the whole notion of bet percentages and money percentages and people are saying, I want to be on, you know, the sports book needs this team to cover because of reverse line movement or whatever, right? When in reality, it can be a 50, you know, they might need that, but they're getting plus 110. If you're taking minus 110, like, sure, you'll be rooting for the same thing that they will, but in the long run, you're going to be losing money and they're going to be making money. So.
Okay. And then we're about to have Cade Massey on to talk some NFL draft. Obviously, the drafting, people start thinking about betting on drafting. And last year, we had someone on to talk about it. We had a Sprott's better to talk a little bit about betting. I think that was on the NBA. But what's your stance on sort of betting on the NFL draft? I know it's something that you don't do, really.
I don't do it.
But
I mean, I think that there's huge opportunities if you're a better, because sports books they're booking this because they feel like they have to, because everybody else is. And I think Jeff Benson said that himself. He said that they've never actually made money booking the NFL draft and they don't enjoy doing it. But, and Derek Stevens said something like that too, but they feel like they kind of have to. And so I think it's so odd that we're not betting on something that's being decided on the field or anything like that. We're literally betting on something that might already be known. And so there's so much inside information. And that's why, I mean, there aren't the same limits there are obviously for betting on football games, but you know, with the way the ecosystem is set up, there are people that can still get down a lot of money. And so, you know, I think that there are edges to be had if you are plugged into this stuff. I'm personally not.
So I've never made a bet
on the NFL draft.
Let's just fast forward. Like, let's say you've lost your ability to bet on anything but the NFL draft. And I give you 1 year to come up with a model.
It's not about
strategy.
A model.
No,
it's
Let me finish, Rufus. A model, a model doesn't have to be a math model. A model can be a framework, right? Like I give you a year to develop something that has you know, like going after this. What are the three things you do in that year?
That's a really good question. And I wish you had told me this was coming because then I could prep for it. I would study historical data first off, because that's who I am, and try to look and see if there's tendencies in teams just to get a broad sense. And I'd also like to look at historical data. I'd like to kind of create some historical data on looking at like what the consensus was from mock drafts a week before, a month before. Right. And we talked with Cade in a little while and about sort of uncertainty and overconfidence. And I'd be curious how overconfident people are a month away from the draft, a week away from the draft, even the night before the draft, on what's going to happen. And if that is priced in, and I would bet, I think it would be really interesting to actually look at previous draft odds. I would try to pull those and kind of see if the large movements are justified generally, or if, I mean, some of them are, you know, movements on some information in quotes that isn't really actually useful, whereas some are on information that is. And so I think, I mean, I would want to gather that data to be able to, I guess, get a broader sense of what these biases are, and figure out how much, like, you know, if in essence, like, let's say something moves from plus 300 and it moves to plus 150, like in the span of, I don't know, whatever, a few minutes, a lot of times that keeps moving, right? And it ends up like minus 300. But in general, are you better off sort of tailing that or fading that? Is that, and basically ways to sort of identify that if in the absence of being able to actually have better information myself, if I can kind of see, if I can kind of get a sense of the sort of market movements, and I don't know, I'm kind of getting lost in my own mind, in my own words here, but just some broader lessons on where there is value. Is that a good enough answer?
Yeah, no, I think it's reasonable. I think it's hard because I think I would have gone to, let me try to network and develop like real relationships.
I mean, obviously, it depends on where your line is, right? In terms of how do you feel?
Yeah, that one, right? As I started talking about it, I'm like, oh, maybe that's kind of feels kind of dirty also. So,
But certainly, right. If you had people in the front, if you develop connections with people in the front offices of these organizations, or, you know, that's why there are so many edges to be had in a way, because there are people that have these connections and have an idea of what's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Let's bring in Cade. We'll talk to you guys all again next week. And I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Cade because it's awesome. We now welcome in good friend, mentor, visionary, Bet the Process inspiration, Cade Massey. Cade, welcome to the Bet the Process podcast. To get us started, obviously we have you on because it's NFL draft week, and rather most people just sit around and talk about all the prop bets, who's going to go first, who's going to be second. We thought it'd be interesting to talk to someone who's been at the ground floor with organizations and generally in analyzing the draft from an analytics perspective. I think first off, it'd be good for you to talk a little bit about what your day job is and how that actually really has brought you into this world of sports.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here. Privileged to be here. I enjoy listening to you guys. I listen to you as often as I can. I get little updates. I like little life updates. I get more life updates off of this show than I do off the phone these days. So I'm thankful for it. Fun week, fun time of year. Obviously, I'm a full-time professor and I studied decision making, and then my PhD was in decision making. And my involvement in this whole thing goes back to grad school and wanting to test this idea of overconfidence in real world data. So psychologists had talked about overconfidence for decades, but they'd mostly studied it in experiments. And this was kind of the dawn of behavioral economics. This, let's take these psych ideas, but test them in real world data. And Thaler and I were both football fans and listened to all the talk. I think this was the 99 draft. We thought, you know, these guys sound a little too sure. They know which of these quarterbacks is going to be the best quarterback. Maybe this is a place we can test overconfidence. So that's the origin. That's why my job is connected to this stuff that I do in sports.
In terms of overconfidence, so what did you guys find in that initial study?
That top picks were overvalued relative to lower picks, especially that first round. The first time we got this result, which showed the value of the picks actually inverted. So instead of the traditional chart where the first pick is, you know, four or five times more valuable than the bottom, the 32nd pick in the first round, you could flip it around. It did flip around. If you looked at what you had to pay these guys and the likelihood one guy was better than the next, it turned out that the most valuable pick in the first round was the last pick in the first round. It total blasphemy, totally surprising. Our reaction was literally, at the time the Bengals weren't any good. They hadn't been good in a long time. Our reaction was, this explains the Cincinnati Bengals, because they've had these first picks, but they're not, they turn out to be the least valuable pick in the first round.
Over time, so that was 25 years ago. Theoretically, right, the teams have gotten better at talent evaluation or not?
Well, also, we have a different rookie pay scale, right? So before first round, like the top picks in the draft were getting a lot of guaranteed money, a lot more than they are now.
So these are the two big possible changes, really. So we know that they get paid less because in what 2011 was it, the rookie scale, it went from being something that was negotiated to being relatively firm, set, and much lower than it was before. But the other question is, are they better at picking these guys, identifying which one's going to be best? And that is one you would think would move, and it doesn't move very much. Then take Jeff, this is something I've looked at a number of times over the years, and you can do it in different ways. But just imagine correlating draft pick with any performance measure. Just pick some performance measure. Like a simple one, this sounds boring, but it's actually a good synthesis of a lot of stuff, is just the number of starts the guy ever gets in his NFL career. But you can use a lot of different stats. And just ask the correlation between, in a draft year, the correlation between where the guy's drafted and the number of starts he has in his career. And then ask, how does that correlation change over time? As a simple measure of whether the league is getting better at this. And the correlation, I don't remember. It's in the middle somewhere, 0.4, 0.5, that correlation. But the thing that matters is, does it change? And it doesn't change very much. I mean, it's like, it's almost perfectly flat over a period of time where analytics, I mean, even going back to the 90s before analytics, really, for 20 years, that correlation, it improves a little bit, but it really doesn't improve very much. And it improves a lot less than you'd think. So you can just look at this, the performance as a function of draft order doesn't change very much. The improvements come from, we pay those top picks less than we used to.
What about if we look at it, I mean, within position? I know now, like, positional value is a big topic in the analytics community. And you know, obviously quarterbacks going at the top of the draft for that reason, but is the variance, I mean, there is a lot more variance I would expect picking a quarterback than there would be picking an offensive tackle there. You know, you know what you're getting in a way. And so is there any sort of difference in our ability to predict within position over the years?
I don't know. I can't speak to how much that changes over time. I don't think that these things are changing much over time, but there are different positions are differently predictable. And I don't have all the differences right off the top of my hand, but you know some of them. So for example, every now and then you run across a very high prospect who's an interior offensive lineman. And they're like guaranteed, not just starters, but some of them are like guaranteed Pro Bowlers. They just know, somehow these scouts know, when the Lindenbaums of the world come around, it's like, maybe it's not the highest positional value, but the variance on that forecast is so tight that they may pull the trigger anyway. Quarterbacks are pretty uncertain, as we know. Wide receivers tend to be, at least at the top of the draft, a little, the decline in their performance is steeper, meaning that we're a little more certain we can identify the top from the next guy. So it does vary by position, but back to Jeff's question, it's not that our overall ability is getting better. And it's not that the guys aren't good at their jobs. Obviously, this is a very hard thing to do. And we keep on throwing more and more technology at it, and we don't get much better. Now, look, technology has gotten a lot better in very recent years. And maybe in the next few years, we'll see some big improvements. For example, all these in-game analytics, we're able to measure what a guy does on the field more precisely than we ever have before, as opposed to just on the combine. I could imagine that that's going to make a difference long-term.
You had another paper that you first presented at Sloan in 2011 that found that there was no, in essence, predictive value to teams being able to generate surplus value from draft picks. Would you agree that that's kind of, can you talk about that a little bit? And is that the same? And
can you actually explain that in a non-Rufus way?
Sorry.
So that was a little started as a little consulting project. A team asked in this case, it was me. They asked me, who is best in the league at drafting? So we say, you know, the draft curves tend to be overconfident. And they ask, well, is somebody good at this? Who should we be learning from? And so I just grabbed some data and looked at it. Essentially, Rufus just mentioned surplus. So all we're saying there, in this case, it's a really different question. We're not going to worry about how much a guy has to be paid. We're just going to ask how much better, how good is the team at picking the best guy? So if you have the seventh pick or the 23rd pick, how good are you picking the best guy? So you have to norm for the pick. You have to say, look, the first pick is going to be better than the 10th on average, which is going to be better than the 32nd on average. And so wherever the team is picking, you have to consider the expected value of that pick. And then just ask, are teams reliably overperforming or underperforming that expected value for that particular guy? So this is ability to pick a player. It's very different from the Massey Taylor stuff. But this was the question. Are some teams good at consistently picking the best player given their draft position, whatever it is? So I go collect these data, and for me, it was an even more shocking result than the one with Taylor, because I thought it would be, you know, heavily chance-driven. But it turned out in the data to be almost completely chance-driven, that the teams obviously do better in some drafts than other teams, but there's no persistence. It's, you know, we look at these things in sports all the time, and it's just the same with the personnel guys. There's no persistence in outperformance one year to the next. The amount of variance that you attribute to individual team differences is in some years zero, not distinguishable from zero, and always very low, always like less than 10% of the variance.
I feel like that's something that's difficult. I mean, it's like trying to identify, you know, a clutch player in golf or something like that. You just, if you just look at it on the whole without any prior, I guess, like it's really hard to find the signal from the noise. I'm curious if you looked at it, if you assumed it would be symmetrical, or if there was any look in. I mean, there's teams that make really dumb decisions, right? Like that, you know, drafting a punter in the third round or something like that.
Yeah.
Or a kicker in the first round, even if he becomes a Pro Bowler. So there are things like that, that like teams tend to do some dumb things. Is there any sort of, it isn't a linear type thing.
It may not be linear, but you've got some selection issues in here. And here's one thing that's true about the NFL draft. I think people may not appreciate is that very few teams do anything consistently. And it's hard to see patterns or policies or philosophies bear fruit one way or the other, good ones or bad ones, if they're doing things inconsistently. And so there's a couple factors here. One is personnel changes, obviously personnel changes, but even within an organization, you have conflicting opinions and beliefs. And so any pick it's almost like the old studies of the firm. It's like our firm's profit maximizing, are they these rational actors, these unitary rational actors? That's not the way firms work. That's the simple model we talk about in corporate finance. It's not the way firms work. It's all these competing forces. And so you've got the general manager who's trying to listen to scouts. Some scouts have stronger voices some years than others. You got the head coach coming in at the last minute with some opinions. You've got some of his position coaches coming in. You got the owner who some years decides to kind of put his thumb on the
scale. Yeah.
You've got all these different forces. The product, the seven picks that are made by most teams in any given season, it's not the same process producing each of those seven picks. It's they're reconciling all these different interests and beliefs. So that's number one. That's the main thing I think people don't understand. So it's rare that you see a philosophy consistent enough to really understand it bearing fruit. But when go back to this question of, are some teams better, or in Rufus's asking, are some teams worse? Here's what we see in the data. Here's another way to look at it. We look at it's because we don't even just know the team. We know who the decision maker is for these teams over decades. And so we can look at individual decision makers, and we can look at a lifetime of their picks. And you can imagine how much the cumulative surplus they've ever generated. This is just performance value over expectation. Sometimes they have the seventh pick. Sometimes they have the 123rd. There's an expected performance value at that position, and then they're going to get more or less from their picks. And imagine what happens after you watch a guy in charge of a few hundred picks. What do you think that curve looks like? Well, he might start out with some positive surplus, and then he starts trending back to zero, or he might start out with some negative surplus, and magically he starts trending to zero. So it's just this law of large numbers where you get this huge normal distribution with the spike around zero among the guys who have been in charge of 100, 200, 300 picks. I mean, you look at Jerry Jones, and you can say Jerry Jones is an awful draft picker, or you can say he made some really good picks, whatever your belief is. Truth is, he's just about zero because he's been in charge of hundreds of picks. And that's what happens when you get a bunch of draws like that. Now, there are some exceptions there, and this is getting closer to your question. What we see when we look at those data, Now we're just plotting all the guys that we've ever watched picks, and we get this big normal curve. But we do see some selection. The guys who start out negative and aren't moving fast enough to zero get selected out. They don't keep their jobs. And so you get this little bias. So the guys you observe the longest tend to be a little more positive. And so there may be a little signal. There is a little signal, but it's like you said, it's really hard to say, okay, there's always going to be some distribution. How do we know when that what looks like choking is truly choking versus just being, you know, a little bit of a negative draw?
Okay, so you studied this clearly. And what I think is fascinating about this is you and I, obviously, we talk a lot about these types of biases and like why people are generally bad at making decisions. It seems like this draft brings them all together, right? Like there's all these reasons why they can't. There's, you know, self-preservation, there's loss aversion, there's all this stuff, right? And so there's bad, like looking at the wrong sort of time horizon, short-term thing, like all that, all incentives. It wraps into all one it. And just manifests it. Itself right. Into the draft. Now you are in charge. What is and we give you a 10-year horizon to assuming 10 years is long enough, but we just say you've got a guaranteed job for 10 years. What's the strategy you implement?
You know, it's a great question, and you've conditioned it exactly right, because I think the thing that analysts get wrong, the unifying mistake that analysts make is they worry about one thing, and general managers worry about 10 or 20 or 35. And you don't really have that perspective until you're in that seat. And so it's so easy for us to say, you should just be maximizing expected surplus, right? It's the one thing you care about. And it turns out the general manager actually cares about a few others, not all of them irrational. So you've just said, look, you can care about, the only thing you have to care about is maximizing wins or the chances of the playoffs or Super Bowl or however you want to put it. It's really hard, Jeff, because we tend to think about these things a pick at a time, which is so wrong. So at the very least, you have to think about it. If you're talking about trading down or trading up, it's not one pick for another pick. It's a bundle of picks for a different bundle of picks. So already we've made it more complicated, and no one talks about it this way. It's the simplest thing you can do, and no one talks about it this way. You've also, by the way, you can't just think about the expected performance of this guy. You have to think about what you're going to pay him. So now you've got a bundle of picks and their cost versus a bundle of picks and their cost. That's the only way to properly evaluate a trade. But it's not even that simple. You've got to think about, if I don't get an edge in the draft, I'm going to have to pick one up in free agency. What's the likelihood of my getting the edge that I need in the draft versus the likelihood in free agency? So now it's not just about the draft. It's about the draft plus the other ways of acquiring talent. I mean, free agency is going to be managing your own roster, your own guys. So it's this huge portfolio problem. No one's ever modeled this whole thing. We have bits and pieces, but we don't have the whole model. If I had 10 years, I had a clean run for 10 years and good resources, I would try to model this whole thing so that because you can't make one decision without affecting your constraints and the other decisions. So it's a whole roster building philosophy. I've got to have multiple years in mind and multiple positions and multiple channels for acquiring those guys before I can come close to saying what's optimal to do in the second round of the draft Friday night.
So you can't tell me whether the Commanders should take Jaden Daniels or Drake May, but can you say that what would be your process there if you were running it based on sort of the insights you've had from working with some professional sports organizations?
So you end up with heuristics, of course. You end up with heuristics. And so we've got a lot of them. And I think, you know, what I'm saying is you got to be one. I think we should be building towards this kind of holy grail of thinking about the whole portfolio, because that's the only way to get our arms around the whole problem. Otherwise, we're just doing one thing at a time. But one of the consequences of that is you got to be a little humble about your heuristics. I've got this heuristic. You should trade down at the top of the draft. And I believe in that, but let's at least have some humility about it. So this is, you know, over time we've learned, you know, quarterbacks may be different. We may be maybe they don't get their full value in free agency. So we're not really capturing that properly in the model, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe quarterbacks have become so valuable now to the game that you do whatever you can to get to them. Possible. So Commanders need a quarterback. They're at the top of the draft. What's the right way to think about this? I do hold strongly to our being too sure we know which of any two or three guys is going to be the best guy. I mean, how many times have we heard this is a generational guy? And, you know, you hear that every few years, which is quicker than every generation. I hold this across multiple worlds, that we're too sure that we can distinguish between two or three, especially, you know, tightly grouped people. So when people say Caleb Williams, you got to take Caleb Williams first, no matter the price, I'm skeptical. And people say, well, it's not a tier of two or three guys at the top. It's Caleb Williams in his own tier. And then the next guys, maybe, and I would trust real experts on that to some extent, but I'm skeptical given the price, the opportunity cost a team bears by actually using the Bears in this case would use that pick when they could trade down, take the next guy and get a whole lot of additional resources.
But let's say you are trying to evaluate these players and you have scouts in there and they're discussing and like how would they ideally come to a consensus?
Well, this is closer to the world that I'm in with these teams these days. So when I first started working with teams, we were talking about this research and you go in with your data and your regressions and you try to convince these guys that they need to manage their portfolio a little differently. And over time, I've worked with teams now for coming up on 20 years. I'm much more about the organizational process. Like, how are you bringing these opinions together? How are you blending? Here's one of the biggest challenges. How are you blending the experts with the analytics guys to reach some kind of consensus? And it's fun and it's challenging. And I think one of the key things is that we have to be humble about what we know. It's really hard to be a scout and most of your professional life is about evaluating these players. And to acknowledge the limit of what you can know, to acknowledge how often you're not right. And it's really just, it's not that they're bad at their jobs, it's that there's only so much you can know. Rufus, you and I have talked about it for years. We've used this phrase for years, irreducible uncertainty. There's a certain amount of irreducible uncertainty. We don't like to acknowledge how much there is. But if that's true, then they need to be open to a number of things. They need to be open to simply aggregating opinions as opposed to like pounding their fist and insisting that they're the one person at the table who's right. They need to be open to people coming in from different backgrounds and having something to say, having the analysts come in. They need to be open. If you understand the limit of what you as an individual can forecast, you get open to edges from anywhere. You should be open to edges from anywhere. New technology comes around. The best organizations, they're a little skeptical when a vendor comes to them with new technology, but they'll try anything essentially. Bring us your evidence. Don't just tell me it's magic. Bring us your evidence. Let us generate evidence and we'll see if it provides us an edge. The best organizations across all these sports are humble about what they can know and therefore they're open to edges from anywhere. Any person, any background, any technology, they just need edges. Everybody wants, the smart ones are like, we'll take an edge from anywhere. But most organizations, that's countercultural, man. It's like, we're the people who know it. I'm the person who's been doing this for 20 years. There's 6 or 8 or 10 or guys around the table who've been doing it with me for 10 or 12 years. They listen to each other and they're not as open to the new voices and new technologies.
Sounds like sports bettors too. But can you talk a little bit more about this mechanical aggregation? Because I know you have a new research paper on it.
So I'm working with a couple of colleagues, Yael Grushka-Kakane and Jason Mayer, a couple of decision scientists who in their normal academic life are interested in aggregating opinions. And they come up with all kinds of fancy ways to aggregate opinions, reach better consensus by aggregating in sophisticated ways. And we thought it'd be interesting to look at draft data to see if we could just mechanically aggregate scouts' opinions and how well we'd do. If we didn't, so these guys, they'll have an organization might have 10, 12, 20 different scouts. They put in reports on players and then at some point they sit around a table, people give some of their reports verbally, they argue it out and they rank the guys.
And they talk about how pretty their girlfriends are, right?
That's what they did in the movie. I don't think these days they're talking as much about that. These can be very sophisticated conversations, but they're spending a lot of time around the table talking these things through. And we wondered how well we could do by just mechanically aggregating the thing. So it's just wisdom of crowds, but we're going to try to do it in kind of a sophisticated way. And we got data from a very sharp team and we played with these data for a long time, tried all these sophisticated things that Yael and Jason have worked on over the years. And we end up just using linear weights. So we end up saying we can't do a whole lot better than just weighing each scout who's put a report in on a player equally. But what's true is if we just mechanically aggregate those reports. We do, I want to say, I'm going to be humble about this. We do as well, approximately as well. In many cases, we do a little bit better than the team's board did without the benefit of all the discussion. And it's not too surprising from a wisdom of crowds perspective, but it is surprising given the resources that all these organizations spend hashing these things out. And I don't doubt that they can do better, but I think that organizations would do better if they leaned more heavily on mechanical aggregation. For example, just set the board, begin. Here's a simple thing, and some baseball teams do this. They're going to let you, they're going to use a model or mechanical aggregation to set the board to begin the conversations. And then they can argue about permutations from there. But man, you can be a whole lot more efficient to just get to that point. And if you never permute the board at all, you're probably going to be fine. But at least you have started, you've raised the floor essentially by just weighing everything equally, getting that as the starting place.
It's almost like, honestly, a sports book taking bets and moving off of action. They're essentially waiting this money that comes in, right? And rather than
interesting,
I don't know. I'm just trying to think of all these parallels.
Well, no, I mean, it's just classic wisdom of the crowds, right? And essentially, what you're doing in this situation is you're like we had talked about this when I worked with the Trailblazers. We'd actually ask them, "Have you ever quantified the effectiveness of any of your scouts?" Right. So if you're able to actually like put a score on them and then use that to weight their opinions and then see if there's a way to sort of aggregate all of that. And so this was, I don't know, 20 some years ago that we did this. So I kind of had a question on like back to what we had talked about, this idea of teams and individual teams. And like the one team, obviously, that we probably have the closest to a view on 20 some years is the Patriots, right? And we had Belichick kind of calling the shots. And there did seem, as at least as a fan, some consistency in the way he approached the draft for a lot of the time he was there, he would try to trade down. He kind of, it seemed like, believed in uncertainty and was always trying to get surplus picks and whatnot. Was there anything that you guys learned from that? Did you observe a change in his behavior towards the end of his tenure with the Patriots?
I honestly haven't studied Belichick in particular, and I'm no Patriot expert. You would know more about that than me, Jeff. But what's true is, even within Belichick, I agree he's a great example because he, back to the, you know, no organization does the same thing for any length of time whatsoever, at least no sports organization, unless they're run by a very strong individual, and the Patriots were for a long time. So you see more consistency from them. Even within that regime, they would trade up some. And it was always interesting when they did. And I'm strongly of the belief, it's like, I can't argue with any given trade, any individual trade. Like, I don't know what signal they're working with. I don't know what the evidence they have. If it's sharp enough, if they're clear enough in their signal that this guy is truly that good, I can't argue with that. And that might be the case in one or two instances. So fine, especially because they have so much of a trade back philosophy. They're basically building capital to work with, and they want to take a shot. Great. Take some shot, dial up the variance. It's the organizations like Dan Snyder had the opposite pattern when he was running the Redskins. I mean, year after year, he'd trade up and he'd consolidate his picks into one chance. And I'm not going to argue with that on one occasion. Fine. You got a signal that says that guy's worth it. Fine. But when you do it every year, year after year, there's no way. The base rates are just against you. What Belichick, and by the way, in our first paper, the Massey Taylor paper, the last thing we do in that paper is say, okay, what about wins? Does this stuff matter in wins? And the way we looked at it was just teams that accumulated draft capital or burned draft capital by just how they manage their picks. Do they trade up? Do they trade back? Do they get future picks? Do they burn future picks? And, you know, the median team in the median year has zero accumulation one way or the other over expected. But some teams vary significantly. And we asked, does that relate to wins? And we found that it did relate to wins. I think one standard deviation movement and how much draft capital you've accumulated over, say, 4 years, up or down, translated to something like 1.5 wins a year, which is a big move in the NFL. And the top two in our window, and I forget exactly what the window was. It was probably the early 2000s, but it was a, I don't know, 8 or 10 year window. the top two teams were the Patriots and the Eagles, and this was in the Belichick era. So it was at good face validity as well. But that's showing that if you manage your draft capital philosophically, consistently, well enough, long enough, that it did have direct consequences. And but note what we're saying here: you don't have to be great at picking players, because that's really hard science. You just manage your capital better, and it's going to accumulate in expectation. It'll accumulate in the wins on the field.
So, Kate, I feel like you are being a classic academic who knows an answer, but needs to work within the industry that isn't willing to listen to that answer. What I mean by that is you've made this distinction that essentially, you know, you don't have a problem with one or two times where people trade up because they have some signal. I think the academic in you would say that's bullshit. No one has that signal. No one should be that confident, right? And so if you are process driven, like we believe people should be, because we're called Bet the process should be simple. It should be always accrue more draft capital, never trade up, believe, you know, like I'm a first principles thinker. First principles in this thing is that no one has any clue how good anyone's going to be. That's inarguable. We can say from the beginning of time that no one knows how good these players are going to be. So if you start with that first principle, then you should always trade down. And then you just said that you saw it in the work that you did, that the people that continued to trade down and get more draft capital generated more wins. So why isn't the answer simple? It is trade down. And obviously things change. This isn't stationary. It may be non-stationary. Who knows? But wouldn't you just tell teams, this is a very simple thing. Get out of your own way. Don't believe that you have the answer. Trade down. Give yourself as many shots on goal as possible, knowing that the last pick in the sixth, seventh round, like the Brock Purdy's, you know, can turn out to be real players. So it's like,
okay, a few things. One, I don't agree that never's the right answer. That I'm open to the possibility that somebody gets a signal sometime and they're willing to, it's okay to act on that. But closely related to that, Jeff, is you might need to dial up the variance on occasion. And so you stack the edges, stack the edges, stack the edges. And then sometimes you might need to push the chips in to dial up variance to just get it over the edge. And I'm not saying that's always the right philosophy or necessarily the right philosophy, but I'm open to that being possibly true. But the biggest answer, the biggest reason that I present it and think about it and believe the way I'm talking about it is from an influence perspective, honestly. And so it's related to how you started it, which is, it's one thing to be right. It's another thing to be effective. And I don't care about being right. I care about organizations actually moving in the right direction. And if they move in the right direction imperfectly, that's better than them not moving in the right direction at all. And if I go in there and tell them, you don't know anything ever, always trade back, they're not going to take it, and they're not going to act, and they're not going to move. But if we say, and I genuinely believe this, odds are against, stack your edges, philosophically accumulate capital. Every now and then, when you're really sure, push the chips in, fine. But that's the exception, not the rule. If that's your approach, much more open, much more willing to take it, much more usable, much more workable. And so if you want to make progress, it requires, I think, that kind of humility, but it's really kind of genuine humility, honestly, Jeff, because there are exceptions. There can be exceptions.
Absence of evidence doesn't imply evidence of absence.
There
right?
you go. There you go. There you go.
In this case, you're saying like the Commanders, if they don't have a strong preference, or if they say, okay, we don't know, any of these three quarterbacks could be really great, and they know other teams are certain, you'd like trade down to the place where they get the last of them, right?
You know,
Now it's four quarterbacks, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
JJ's getting top 10 buzz all the, like.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. That's now. Well, right. No, through three, meaning the three that they could pick, because Caleb Williams is going number one.
And so this is, I'd rather fight this battle, Jeff, but this is also a challenge, because I strongly, philosophically, religiously believe that it's like, whatever true differences there are in these expected differences in these four quarterbacks, it's going to pale compared to the price of them. So if someone else wants to pay you to choose among them, great, let them pay you to choose among them and take the one that falls to you. I deeply believe that among tightly clustered players like this. But that's just not the way scouting works in professional sports. It's so hard for them to be indifferent about which guy. You know, they've been looking at these guys for a year. That whole the scouts have, the whole team has been looking at them in detail for months. They've been talking about them in the hallways and over lunch. They care which of the four guys they end up with. And it's so hard for them just to play the edges. That's a battle that's worth fighting. I strongly believe it's so hard. You have to get them to basically just focus on the odds and not the individuals. And it's really hard to do.
That's why you need bettors owning teams. You need people like Haralabis, you know, he owns that team in Spain's second league, third league. Yeah. And well,
who's your buddy? Who's your buddy with y'all had someone on, a friend of y'all's, who owns a third or fourth tier team in England. And he goes over there in his first year and he's like, yeah, I thought I was going to do it that way. And then I learned that it's hard not to care about these as individuals. It's hard not to listen to the fans. Your betting buddy had that exact experience when he owned a team. He just changed seats. Same guy. One day he doesn't own the team. He can take all the shots he wants to and talk about numbers. The next day he owns the team, and the whole first year he's like, oh hell, we had a hard time making hard decisions.
Haralabob actually worked for the Mavericks first though, too. So he kind of got to see how organizations work. And
I don't know about his experience. I'm talking about your guy.
Yes, no, Preston.
Is it Preston? Okay, Preston.
Yeah. So I'm like one statement, and then Rufus, I'll turn it over to you if you want to ask one last question, we can get Kate out of here. But it is the draft, well, owning teams specifically, and then even more specifically the draft, are some of the greatest highlights I've ever seen of cognitive bias and, you know, behavioral economics and why people make bad decisions, right? There's just all these factors that we talked about, which is just, it's just fascinating. And I think from your standpoint, what I'm starting to really understand more is this organizational dynamic of how you influence organizations. You know, my career has started in startups and moved to big companies and now moved, you know, kind of to a hybrid of both, and understanding how to have influence in organizations in a big company certainly is very different than in a startup, when you just can be a maverick and say, I'm going to do what I want to do. Right. So Rufus, you want to ask one last question to Cade?
Oh, I thought you were asking you, there's no question there.
There's no question. Just wanted to tie something up.
Well, Cade pointed me to this paper he did with Zach Drapkin, who was, I guess, your mentee, or were you an advisor for him, Cade? And then he's now working for a professional.
Yeah, Drapkin was a Penn undergrad. He talked his way into being an intern on Wharton Moneyball from like his first year. And he was just extraordinary student, helper, friend. He interned with a number of different, he interned at PFF, interned with the Ravens, and now he's full-time with the Eagles, Zach Drapkin.
But you pointed me to this paper that you two co-authored, where you showed that even if you knew which player was going to be the best in a draft, that the chart, in essence, is still overvaluing the right to choose. It's still overvaluing the top picks, which to me is just kind of insane that that's possible.
Yeah, I felt like it could have been the last word on whether the chart is too steep. I mean, it's like we don't do any estimation. We don't make any assumptions. We just go in and say, after the fact, let's just look at which player was the best player. And then let's look at the second best player and just move the chart that way. Like the ex post realization of the value of the player. If we could order the right to choose by their ultimately known value, how steep would the curve be? And in every year we looked for 6 or 7 years that we had the window post rookie cap that we could look at. Every year the actual trade chart was steeper than what we call the fortune teller's chart. And that's even before you pay the guys. So it's just absurdly conservative that even with perfect knowledge of which player is going to be best, and even if you don't have to pay them, the right to choose would be muted compared to what you have to pay if you're going to trade picks.
Okay. And my last question, I kind of want to just bring everything together a little bit, as we are a betting podcast, but I feel like we've gotten all these lessons here, and that definitely can apply to betting. And so I guess, what would you say, like, how can bettors use some of your findings to be better at avoiding mistakes?
I don't know, Rufus. I feel like all that I know in this world has been so influenced by you over the years, the Massey Peabody work, working with these teams. It's all kind of mixed in together. And what we've just talked about essentially is blending models with expert judgment. And, you know, I've had the individual conversations with each of you over the years about how we do that. What's the right way to blend models and individual and expert judgment? Y'all have the benefit of kind of living without all these organizational complications and without the organizational politics. You can just run your model and bet your model. And mostly that's what you do. And I think that's wise in the worlds that you live in. When we move to these organizational realities, it gets a little more complicated. But for bettors, I mean, I don't know what to say other than, I mean, have a lot of humility about your model, but even have more humility about your ability to intuitively improve your model and just keep on refining both.
All right, Cade, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an awesome, awesome appearance. We'll have to have you on again soon. Thank you so much and happy drafting.
Thanks, man. Thoroughly enjoyed. Good to see y'all.
Thanks, Cade. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off of leaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information, turn the losing bettors into winners. Yeah. Sperm Herm, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.